And we'll next be proceeding to our third of three oral arguments this morning. Judges Werke and Bond join myself, Judge Sleater. The file number for this third oral argument, A24-1829, Stephen Van Kuyk, appellant, versus Linda Steen et al. As respondents. And I do ask counsel for appellant to correct my pronunciation if I said it wrong.
My client's the hard one, and you got it just right.
Very good. Thank you. As a reminder to counsel, we are live streaming these proceedings as well as recording them. The recording will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. No other recording is allowed absent prior approval, but for that reason, we do also ask counsel to identify yourself, your name for the record, and who you represent when you begin your comments. The podium can be adjustable by a knob on the front face of the podium, and then we also ask that you keep your eye on the clock, of course, in the upper right portion of that podium. So with those comments in mind, counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin your comments.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Stephen Applegate. That is Stephen with a V, and it is spelled A-P-P-E-L-G-E-T. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Well, you'll actually get five if you
desire. I get five automatically.
You don't need to use it all, but you're welcome to.
Thank you. I believe it was Leo Tolstoy said that every happy family is the same, but he said something like every unhappy family has a great story. This is a family that started very happy and ended up as perhaps the most unhappy. And I'm not sure what sort of reversal of fortune story the great Tolstoy would tell about this. The story begins when Mr. Van Kuyk and Linda Steen meet. They become a committed couple. They join their lives together. But unfortunately, for the convenience of everyone, they do not get married. They purchase a house together in Shoreview. There's no dispute that they shared the purchase price, they shared responsibility, they're both on the title, they're both on the mortgage, they paid the property taxes, the utilities, the mortgage payments, everything together. As time went along, as laymen are wont to do, Mr. Van Kuyk became convinced that, you know, perhaps transferring title to just Ms. Steen, his partner, would accrue an advantage in the property taxes. Was that belief mistaken? Sure was. Sure was. But in fact, he did it. There is a quitclaim deed in the file. It was registered with Ramsey County properly. It was all done. But the context of that quitclaim deed is not a simple transfer of the property.
Mr. Applegate, can I jump ahead a bit to your client's complaint? Isn't the chief or the fatal argument in terms of an equitable cause is that your client didn't plead promissory estoppel?
He did not plead it directly, but it is sort of implied in the entire concept of partition under the idea of Swoger v. Taylor, that all these equitable doctrines are sort of combined into the equitable power of the court once partition is in play.
But isn't it your client's obligation under declaratory judgment in order to successfully declare himself an owner of property of which it's undisputed he is not a named title holder anymore to plead the specific equitable relief that gets him there for either declaratory judgment or partition? And so, as the judge pointed out, it wasn't alleged, and so there's no allegations and hence no specific evidence in any event of being induced by a promise to transfer.
To the extent that the pleading itself isn't perfect, and we'll admit the pleadings aren't great in this case, The answer and counterclaim are kind of a mess too. But I think the way the parties actually handled this at summary judgment, it was an issue that was tried and was actually decided by Judge Hsu. So sort of by consent of the parties, this came into play.
Well, just to clarify, Judge Hsu does first point out that it's not pled, correct?
Yes.
And then does go on, even if, I think, if, I can't remember the exact phrase, even if it had been or even if it was, then went on. So would we need to go beyond the fact that it wasn't pled, therefore affirm the order in that
regard? I think that also is handled by the idea of the consent of the parties. I'd also say that that also handles the counterclaims that were never addressed by Judge Hsu as well, because those were sort of dismissed by consent of the parties, by abandonment by the defendant, and then sort of sub rosa decision by Judge Hsu to have a judgment but not actually address the counterclaims regarding the Florida property.
Well, let me ask a follow-up then. Even if we assume there was consent and the judge looked at it that way, and that's why the judge referenced it, I'm looking at your client's affidavit, which seems consistent with his testimony in the separate guardianship proceeding. On paragraph 8, number 8 of his affidavit, I came to believe that we would gain a tax advantage. That's how you started out this morning, by transferring the on-paper ownership of the house from the two of us together to be solely in Linda's name. And then paragraph number 9, your client indicates Linda was reluctant to do this, but I wrongly believe our tax savings would be substantial. My question is, doesn't that suggest, even if we were to consider promissory estoppel, it's counter to that because she didn't even want to do it, so it wouldn't have been based on a promise she would have made to your client that induced him. It looks like between this and the transcript from the guardianship proceeding, this was, as you say, his layman's best opinion, however source he got that information to do it, so he was going to do it and convinced her to do it. So how possibly could that be an inducement?
The inducement is their prior dealings, their prior promises to each other, and then their later dealings to where he remains in the house, keeps making payments, makes improvements, doesn't pay any rent. So it's sort of a totality of the circumstances, which is always, of course, Your Honors, the mess with equity, is that we're always looking at, you know, all the wild things that people do when they don't consult a lawyer before signing documents. So our argument is that he was, in fact, induced by the prior by the prior conduct, and then his continuing to perform is then further induced by, she doesn't kick him out.
He found out that the tax deal that he thought would be a benefit, he didn't do anything to correct the situation after that. I mean, you talk about a layperson not consulting with an attorney in the first instance, but then he finds out that he screwed up and the interest was conveyed, but he didn't do anything. So he's kind of made the same mistake twice, not
sure,
consulting
an
attorney and then not doing anything after the fact.
Correct, Your Honor. That is why, as
so
I
how
often...
How do we fix that? We don't... There's, as far as I can see, there's... Point to me anything in the record that shows, other than his own assertions, that this wasn't the deal that he created. I mean, he's saying we have mutual promises, we're going to love each other forever, or whatever the couple relationship issues, but other than those assertions, what else is in the record that would defeat the summary judgment determination?
Well, there is his actions, but I think those tie in with the same concerns that Your Honor has. What I would say to that is, if we were dealing with a true third party who is not, you know, Ms. Steen or Ms. Steen's representative and Mr. Van Kuyke, I think that argument would be much, much stronger, that a third party doesn't have to worry about that. But the commencement of this case, it is a dispute between Mr. Van Kuyke and Ms. Steen, even though, I mean, she was under guardianship, but it is, you know, her. So the extent Ms. Steen should be bound to the deal that she made.
What deal did she make? In the record, what evidence is there she made a deal?
The deal is that there would be less property tax, or less, I'm even confused about what they thought the tax advantage is, but that the couple would pay less tax. Obviously, they're filing separately, but they had joint, you know, joint household finances, even if they cannot file their taxes jointly.
But
they both benefit off of that.
I understand that, but I think I understand that. But the point being, for promissory estoppel, again, assuming we were to get to that, the evidence all indicates that he got this bad information and he did it, even to her reluctance. So wouldn't promissory estoppel be a scenario perhaps similar like the Bifalka case in which she says, I want to save taxes, and the best way we can do it is for you to transfer here, but I promise you, you have part ownership, equal ownership in it. That's the sort of inducement that your client could then show, I've been induced to do this, but he did it all on his own.
Okay, I think I know what we're getting at and where my confusion is. As part of our argument, I think what our issue was is that that was a factual issue outstanding, and a good part of our appeal is based on Judge Shue resolving that factual issue about what the parties were thinking. There was no testimony. There was simply, you know, the affidavit of Mr. Van Kuyke. Ms. Steen obviously cannot provide an affidavit. And that was the error to grant summary judgment instead of taking this to, you know, a trial and having a, you know, factual determination based on testimony and such.
Would your client agree on the second issue partition that if we disagreed with you and affirmed the district court, that would naturally fall away? In other words, we wouldn't have to resolve it. The only way you would get to a partition is, as you were pointed out earlier, you have to have an equitable interest. So if we were to remand for trial, then it would still be on the table. But if we affirmed a dismissal on issue one, there can be no partition.
Yes, as I was preparing, I sort of was, you know, going back over the old stuff. And I think it makes sense more that, you know, the declaratory relief, you know, sort of provides the cause of action. Partition is the remedy, but, you know, there's some amount of little bit of overlap, but not a huge amount. I think the distinction is, you know, 90% clear there. So let's get to partition. Let's talk about partition. As the Supreme Court held in Carlson v. Olson, which I know much of the holding has been abrogated by statute, but the underlying idea is that unmarried couples can have property together and their relationships can be complex, and the court can look at that complexity. And that's also echoed in Swoger v. Taylor about how equity is built into the mechanics of the partition statute. And the partition statute itself has been essentially unamended since territorial days. It's just floated along. It's a weird thing to work with the really old law, that stuff. But equity is sort of built into it. But it was an error for Judge Shue to make the factual determination that there was no deal. And that, of course, tracks back to the declaratory judgment cause of action. I'm going to cover Torrance Property in 2 minutes here. Torrance Property 508.225. Transfers are, you know, essentially inviolable if at the time of the transfer, the transfer is done in good faith and it's for valuable consideration. Now, we've got a dilemma here with the valuable consideration. If there was no consideration, with no promises, then Torrens is not going to apply. It's not a transfer for valuable consideration. Either there's a deal or Torrens doesn't apply. There's also the problem that at the time, Ms. Steen, knew of the mutual promises. She knew the circumstances of this. She's not just a third party taking this property blind with, you know, whatever sort of mystery is happening behind the curtain. She is behind the curtain. She's right there with it. She knew that this was a complex, strange situation. And I got it done in under 2 minutes, Your Honors. Unless the court has any questions, I'll yield my time.
Excellent. I don't see any. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And counsel for respondent, you may approach and identify yourself, and when ready, begin your comments.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Dan Kufis, and I am representing Kimberly Phillipson, both individually and in her capacity as the personal representative of the estate of Linda Steen. Now, we are asking the court to uphold the court's summary judgment order from September 23rd, 2024, granting our request for summary judgment. Now, opposing counsel mentioned Tolstoy at the beginning, and I will tell you right off the bat that I don't have the attention span to read Tolstoy. So I want to analogize it to something that's a little bit more up my alley, and that's Choose Your Own Adventures. When you were a kid, you got to read the books Choose Your Own Adventures. My kids read them in school right now. And I would analogize this because any adventure that you take, it comes back to the same decision. Summary judgment is appropriate, and we've got multiple ways that we can get to that summary judgment. And I'd also like to clarify, just because it was stated early on in the record, that there was somehow some consent of the parties for an expansion of the pleadings. That's simply not true. That is simply not true. We addressed issues as if they were possibly pled, but we have never consented to this extension of the pleading. So,
is that how you interpret the district court's order? I think counsel for appellant seemed to construe it similar to a consent in the way the court analyzed promissory estoppel.
No, I think it's going back to one of those choose your own adventures. If it doesn't work here, it works this way. That's how I see it, that even if he had properly pled the issue of promissory estoppel, he doesn't get where he wants to get. That's how I interpreted the judge's reading of that. And the certificate, I think blowing over this Torrens property idea is incorrect. I mean, the certificate of title is not presumptive. In this case, it's invincible. Mr. Applegett mentioned in his pleading that there's no valuable consideration. That yet the very document that Mr. Van Kuyk drafted, the very document that Mr. Van Kuyk signed in the presence of a notary, we can assume it was sworn, said that the transaction was for valuable consideration.
The face of the quit claim deed is, you're talking about the language that's in the pre-printed document?
It says right, the very first line is for valuable consideration. Yep, so that is what I'm referring to. And so,
and wouldn't consideration also have been the fact there was possibly a tax deal that would result?
Yeah, I mean, there could have been, we don't know. I mean, it was 10 years ago. We don't know what the consideration was. And that he, in essence, testified to the issue that there was valuable consideration, I think that ends it. And the other possibility when dealing with Torrens property, if it wasn't good faith. So to get out of this Torrens conundrum that he finds himself in, he would have to say that he acted in bad faith and that he signed a sworn document under oath for valuable consideration, that there was no valuable consideration.
Counsel, could you explain to me the relevance of the distinction in any event between abstract property and Torrens property, because I assume if it's abstract property and you transfer, you got the same issue, or we'd have the same issue before as if the quitclaim deed had been via abstract property. The only thing that abstract property requires is you have to go through the history of it to a title opinion before you transfer it, but you're still going to have to look at the records when you do Torrens property. So would I be safe in saying that that really is not an important distinction either in looking at some of the cases the parties have cited or the fact that this particular quitclaim deed was on Torrens property?
No, Your Honor. I would disagree in the sense that I think that what the Torrens does is it makes it the invincible. Abstract property would allow for some equitable relief as a possibility. I don't see that as a possibility in Torrens.
Maybe ask it slightly different way. You say invincible, and maybe you're back to the Avengers analogy of some sort. But
Avengers, Your Honor.
The fact is, you can, if you had proper evidence to support a promissory estoppel, you could obtain equitable title to Torrens property despite the language on the Torrens certificate.
If there's no good faith, if you can prove that there's no good faith, and if you can prove that there's no valuable consideration. That's right in the 508.25.
But couldn't you prove promissory estoppel and that would be sufficient?
Again, you would have to, if you can show that there was bad faith in the dealing, if you can show that there was no consideration, then I think you can get into this.
In other words, Pavelka, although that was abstract property, would have, those same facts would have led our court to the same decision on Torrens property if there's a proof of a promise that induced an agreement to transfer and a detrimental reliance on that.
If I think you would still need to get to that bad faith, and I think you would still need to get to the valuable consideration issue. I think that's where the distinction is between the two of them.
Thank you.
The abstract and the other major distinction between Pavleka and what we're dealing with here, aside from the abstract issue, is that they pled promissory estoppel. They asked for it in the initial documents. So the idea that this deed that again states for valuable consideration is somehow invalid or didn't encompass what the or you know is would be inappropriate for the court. And while the court may have made findings regarding potential factual issues on it, I think that the law itself precludes any of those factual issues from coming into play. So in addition to that, where if we're looking at not only pleading the promissory estoppel, the actual pleading itself dealt with declaratory judgment under 555.02. And under 555.02, that allows the court to interpret a written document. In this case, there is no written document. It's an equitable relief that he's going for. So that is the second pleading that it doesn't get to where he's looking to go. In 555.02, any person interested under a deed, will, written contract, or other writing constituting a contract, that wasn't... that's what was pled in this issue. Addition, if we're going back with our adventures, Your Honors, it's I think we've got another one that's under the statute of frauds. Statute of frauds would bar any sort of oral agreement from in this case. So that's under 513.04, prohibits the enforcement of any oral agreement concerning real estate unless memorialized in writing. Appellant provides no writing in this case. He is his only evidence of this is a self-supporting affidavit that was filed in a court with another party to this that's unable to transact. He has provided no evidence of any sort of written understanding at all. And I think, Your Honors, when I look at this, and the other issue that would bar or that would support the summary judgment motion is this issue of res judicata.
I can't follow that argument at all. Res judicata on a guardianship? A guardianship proceeding, as I understand it, the tussle was over who was going to be named as guardian. Where does real estate come into play in a guardianship proceeding?
Well, Your Honor, it was a guardianship and a conservatorship. And so what we have, for it to be collaterally estopped...
That issue wasn't... First of all, was that issue presented to the district court?
The
Isn't
issue
this
of,
something on an appeal that you're now bringing up this as an avenue and adventure that you want us to look at?
Yeah, we raised it in the summary judgment motion as well. we raised it in our summary judgment motion, that we have a court of competent jurisdiction. He was represented.
Where was it litigated? Where was the property ownership litigated, in the conservatorship or the guardianship?
Well, the litigation in the conservatorship would be for who owns the property of Ms. Steen. We may not have come out and said, you know, that this is an issue that we're claiming interest within the household.
Well, that's what res judicata means, is that the issue has already been litigated and has been determined. It wasn't litigated. What was litigated was who was going to be taking over.
For a conservatorship. So, Your Honor, yes, I will cede that point that it wasn't specifically litigated there, but his testimony still came out. So the only two times where we've had Mr. Van Kuyk under oath, one on the deed that says for valuable consideration, it's a subscribed and sworn statement, and number two was his testimony during the guardianship proceeding, that he had no ownership interest in the house. And that was adopted by the court and not appealed. So his request to overcome summary judgment, we believe, falls on multiple independent legal grounds. He has no current title interest, pled no equitable theory, and he cannot overcome the Torrens registration system or the statute of frauds. Now, I think that I'm not dealing with the partition because I think when there's no equitable claims, when there's nothing to deal with, then I think that the partition does just go away. Partition, you have to have an interest in the house, and at this point right now, he has none. So we are asking that the court affirms the trial court's decision granting summary judgment and dismissing his complaint. Are there any questions that Your Honors have for me?
I see no other questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. I appreciate it. And counsel for appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Although if you prefer four, as you indicated earlier, that's fine as well.
Your Honors, I did high school debate long enough that four-minute rebuttals are burned into my consciousness. When I'm in the nursing home, I will know exactly how long 4 minutes for my 1AR is. I don't think there's a lot to cover. I think Your Honors addressed what we are concerned with. But I want to go back to the idea that there is that the defense has a bit of a dilemma. Either there was valuable consideration, and that valuable consideration is demonstrated by the promises, and it's demonstrated by the part performance by Mr. Van Kuyk that gets us out of the statute of frauds. We briefed that up. Either there is consideration or there is not. If there is consideration, then we have the right to, you know, have the deal construed. If there is not consideration, then this thing is out of Torrens, and the transfer itself has some real problems. I think that's a real dilemma for the defense. But what it comes down to, this is people living their messy lives, doing messy things, you know, moving valuable property without considering all the legalities. It's the sort of things that if you call your lawyer says, oh, no. Think that through. We'd be out of business if people followed through with getting consultations beforehand. This is a mess. This is a mess like Carlson v. Olson was a mess, where an unmarried couple had property together, lived together, but didn't bother to actually tie the knot. This is a mess like Swogert v. Taylor, where a family has a farm, a truck farm business, and don't resolve it. Unfortunately, it is up to the courts to resolve these sorts of circumstances. And it's messy. It's fact-dependent. And it turns into Tolstoy novels. Sometimes it turns into Dostoevsky novels, but we sort of hope that it does not, because those are even worse. But the key to our argument is that the facts are up in the air, and Judge Hsu improperly granted summary judgment when the facts are up in the air. This should be remanded for trial on the merits. And if the court has no more questions, we can go to lunch early.
Very good. I see no questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today, as well as your briefing. We now take the matter under advisement. We'll issue a ruling within 90 days. Have a good day. And we now adjourn to consider our non-oral matters.
All right.